One by one, the speakers took to the podium, erected on the pavement outside the Bahraini embassy in London, with a message of defiance and resistance.
We cannot continue to be controlled and ruled by hereditary dictatorships. That time has finished. It must cease to continue. It must come to an end. That is what our people in Bahrain want to achieve, and inshallah, they will achieve that.
In the decade plus since the revolution, Manama has even managed to export some of its violence.
They are participating in helping in bombing the Yemeni children, the Yemeni women. How can this be justified by the Bahraini regime? They are also, on the other hand, have sold the lands of the Arabs and Muslims in Palestine. They have kneeled to the wishes of the Zionists, the international Zionism.
Bahrain has featured on UK parliamentary agendas, has been the subject of official inquiries with the British government, but still no progress. This as activists seek a peaceful path to lasting reforms.
It's very unfortunate that what is called international community is headed by some who are the main reason for the problems in the world. The United States and Western Europe, who are backing the dictators rather than backing the people.
Activists argue the continuing atrocities committed against the Bahraini people can only happen with the consent of the international community, and are urging fresh action, not just words.
After over a decade of broken promises, false dawns, imprisonment, intimidation, torture, and even death, the brave freedom fighters for Bahrain have pledged to fight on to get Bahrain and its people the justice they're owed. Amina Taylor, London.
The central mosque of Kashmir's capital state, Srinagar, has stood for centuries as a pedestal of religious and political activities in this Muslim-majority region. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims from different parts of Kashmir would gather here on Fridays, filling lanes and roads to say prayers in this centuries-old mosque. But now, after India abrogated Kashmir's special status in August 2019, this 600-year-old mosque remains shuttered.
This is a place of worship. Why did they impose restrictions on our religious activities when there is no lockdown for other religious activities or social and political activities? Why here? COVID is just a pretext that the government is using.
The Indian authorities see the Grand Mosque as the epicenter for anti-India protests and clashes. For decades, authorities in Kashmir have struggled to contain the sentiments in this region claimed by both India and Pakistan, but ruled in parts. The mosque, with the capacity to hold 33,000 devotees, is surrounded by a wider market that is defunct following the closure.
Fridays or occasions like Eid were the days when we would earn sustenance. For the past 2.5 years, handling family and home affairs has been tough. If authorities continue to keep this mosque closed, our families would crumble and we will be pushed into poverty.
Though the religious freedom is enshrined in the Indian constitution, people in Indian-administered Kashmir say the continued closure of Kashmir's Grand Mosque belies India's claims of religious freedom, equality and justice in Kashmir. Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
It was a night of happy tears and regret for Iranian cineasts and filmmakers. The closing ceremony of the 40th Fajr Film Festival saw the announcement of the best films on Friday. After 10 days of a tight competition, everybody now holds their breaths as the jury announces the winners. The award for Best Leading Actress went to Tanaz Tabatabai for her performance in Without Her.
It was hard, but we nailed it. I should thank every single one of the cast and crew. If it wasn't for their efforts, I would have not been standing here.
And acclaimed Iranian actor Amin Hayai nabbed the award for Best Leading Actor for starring in The Last Snow.
This is my second Simorgh Award. This time too, I worked with crew members who put all their energy into the film. And this led me to win the award again.
A lineup of 22 films, mostly made by the new generation of Iranian filmmakers, competed for a Crystal Seymour as the top prize of the festival. The Situation of Mehdi pocketed the awards in five categories, including Best Direction, Best Visual Effects, and Best Sound Mixing, as well as the Golden Seymour Award for the top film of the festival. Directed by Hadi Hejazi Farr, the war drama documents two major operations Iran-Canada during the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War. Laureates believe the cinematic event has played a major role in upgrading the Iranian cinema industry.
I'm so happy to be acknowledged in my first presence as a director in the festival. I should thank all of those who supported me. The festival encourages the filmmakers to try to excel, and this is what makes the entire film industry grow.
Fajr Film Festival is held every year on the anniversary of the victory of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution. The 40th edition of the cinematic event kicked off on February the 1st and screened feature and short films as well as documentaries over the course of 10 days.
The 40th Fajr Film Festival rolled back the red carpet with smiles and tears. For sure, it was a memorable night for those who nabbed the Crystal Seymour, as their films will definitely go down in the list of the blockbusters of Iranian flicks. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Painting pictures of a revolution that shook the world to its core more than four decades ago. Children born here, but staying connected to Iran.
I think the Islamic Revolution has brought a lot of joy to many people, and basically it shows that we are Muslims and we are proud of who we are.
The paintings are part of a ceremony at the Islamic Center of England, in the heart of London, on the 43rd anniversary of a day that changed the course of Iranian history.
Before the Islamic Revolution in Iran, there was not such a good relationship, from the Pahlavi regime with the religion, and because it was based on a secular system.
Led from exile in France by Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the uprising toppled a U.S.-backed despotic monarchy and replaced it with an Islamic republic, ushering in an era of political freedoms and independence from foreign influence. To the Shah's Western backers, the perceived loss of a modernized Iran under his rule to an Islamic republic was a consequential blow to their interests in the region. What followed was four difficult decades that saw a devastating Western-backed war in the 1980s, an ongoing economic war, military threats, and relentless demonization.
The West hates Iran. They surround it with military bases. They supplied bombs and ammunition and poison gas. The extraordinary thing, though, is that Iran is probably at a point where instead of being on the defensive, it may be able to go forward and give a lead to a world badly in need of a new lead.
To other non-Iranians, the revolution has qualities that makes it relevant to the world today.
For me, as a Muslim in the 21st century, it's important to try to find leadership that instills the concept of taqwa, that instills the concept of piety, and talks about the concept of unity.
For more than four decades now, Iran has defied many who had predicted the revolution's imminent collapse. At 43, these participants tell us it's a stable country in an unstable region, powerful militarily, and as united as ever against hegemonic powers. Saeed Purizep, London.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
According to public polls, widespread economic discontent and frustration over the coronavirus pandemic have battered U.S. President Joe Biden's approval ratings, now hovering just above 40%. We now present you an article written by The Guardian journalist Lauren Gambino. The piece is titled, Embrace or Avoid? Midterms dilemma for U.S. Democrats as Biden's ratings plunge. With a handshake and a brief embrace, U.S. Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger welcomed President Joe Biden to her Virginia district recently. The event was an opportunity to highlight the Biden administration's plans to lower the cost of prescription drugs, but it also provided an opportunity for the U.S. president to promote the members of his party ahead of the midterm elections this November. It is a crucial effort. Democrats already face a punishing political climate as they defend their paper-thin majorities in the House and Senate. The president's party typically loses seats during the midterm elections, and a president's popularity is a key variable in determining the extent of those losses. According to the public opinion polls, widespread economic discontent and frustration over the coronavirus pandemic have battered Joe Biden's approval ratings, now hovering just above 40%. Underscoring the deep challenges confronting his presidency, Joe Biden arrived in Culpeper, Virginia, just hours after the release of another grim economic report showing inflation rising by 7.5% over the last year, its highest level in the past 40 years. The present reality poses a dilemma for some Democrats: embrace an unpopular president or shun the leader of their party. Republicans have called the choice the burden of Biden, targeting members who appear with him, like Abigail Spanberger, over their support for the president while accusing those who don't of avoiding him. Practically a perennial midterm predicament for the party in power, the question of whether to put daylight between vulnerable candidates and President Joe Biden comes as he prepares to ramp up trouble outside of Washington. This week he will travel to Ohio, where Democrats are trying to flip a Senate seat. Some Democrats are hopeful the personal appeal of Joe Biden will help them sell their agenda and improve his party's prospects later on this year. Lanai Erickson, senior vice president at the moderate think tank Third Way, claimed, "If you are trying to distance yourself from Biden, you're doing it wrong." Many of the most fiercely contested House races are anchored in the suburbs, which powered the party's big victories during the Donald Trump years, but where Democrats have struggled recently. Lanai Erickson said, "Joe Biden remains the party's spokesman." She continued, "A visit from him telegraphs to swing voters, and this is the party of Joe Biden. It's not the party of Bernie Sanders, and that's why we're offering when it comes to November." In recent weeks, some Democrats have not attended events where Biden is speaking, giving grist to Republicans eager to amplify the narrative that they are avoiding him. On a trip to Georgia, where Biden delivered a major speech on voting rights, Gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams, a prominent voting rights advocate, was not in attendance, citing a scheduling conflict. In Pittsburgh recently, Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro, the probable Democratic nominee in the race for governor, did not attend the president's speech on infrastructure, also due to an apparent scheduling conflict. Both insisted at the time politics had no bearing on their decision. Stacey Abrams and Joe Biden flatly rejected any notion of friction. But there are other signs that Democrats in difficult races are trying to put daylight between themselves and the president. Asked whether he would accept Joe Biden's help, Beto O'Rourke, who is vying to become the next governor of Texas, told reporters he was not interested in receiving campaign assistance from anyone outside of his state. Other Democrats have hedged, offering neither an emphatic yes or a definitive no. An analysis by Axios website using data compiled by Quorum found that many at-risk Democrats avoided any mention of the president on their official campaign accounts since 1st of September, when Joe Biden's approval rating began a precipitous decline after the chaotic withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. Still, several Democrats in key races have welcomed the president. Georgia Senator Raphael Warnock, who faces a difficult re-election fight, appeared alongside Joe Biden during his voting rights speech. Congressman Conor Lamb, a candidate for Senate in Pennsylvania, was in the audience in Pittsburgh when Joe Biden mistakenly referred to him as Senator. In December, Kansas Congresswoman Charisse Davids flew with Joe Biden on Air Force One to her district, where they touted the benefits of the bipartisan infrastructure law. And he also appeared at an event with Michigan Congresswoman Elisa Slotkin to push the passage of the law. A recent survey of Arizona voters conducted by OH Predictive Insights, Nobel's polling and research firm, found that the economy had overtaken immigration as a top priority for voters in the border states. At the same time, approval of his handling of the economy and the pandemic had fallen sharply. At a press conference recently, Joe Biden said he planned to be more deeply involved in the midterm elections. And though he expressed an eagerness to travel on behalf of his party, it is highly unlikely that Biden would appear anywhere he's not wanted. He said, "We're going to be raising a lot of money. We're going to be out there making sure that we're helping all of those candidates," claiming, "And scores of them have already asked me to come in and campaign with them, to go out and make the case in plain, simple language as to what it is we've done, what we want to do, and why we think it's important. But it is not easy." Once popular with a wide cross-section of voters, Joe Biden's appeal among conservatives has all but vanished as he attempts to lead a divided America out of a pandemic and an economic crisis. His appearances almost always draw protesters, often waving vulgar signs as Donald Trump continues to spread lies about the results of the 2020 presidential election. Alarming Democrats is his slipping support among critical parts of the party's coalition, including Black, Latino, young and female voters, deflated by his failure to enact a bold agenda and disappointed that life remains far from normal more than a year into his presidency. Cliff Albright, a co-founder of the Atlanta-based advocacy group Black Voters Matter, said the collapse of legislative efforts to protect voting rights and enact police reform should worry Democrats more than an appearance by President Biden. In a recent survey by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, nearly a quarter of Georgia voters named voting and elections as their top priority, the highest percentage on any issue, including the economy. Concern was especially pronounced among Black voters, whose disapproval of the president soared from just 8% in May to 36% in January. Even a marginal drop in black voter turnout in November could spell trouble for Democrats in November, particularly in Georgia, where Joe Biden won by less than half of a percentage point. 4 years ago, voter fury against Donald Trump lifted Abigail Spanberger to victory over Republican David Bratt, an arch-conservative. Abigail Spanberger has been a top Republican target ever since, but she held on in 2020, defeating her Republican challenger by less than 2 percentage points. This year, she will run in a district that has been dramatically redrawn and now tilts more heavily in her favor. Whereas Joe Biden narrowly won her district in 2020, it's projected he would have won the new district by 7 percentage points. But the increased margin is little comfort after Democrats' stunning defeat in Virginia's gubernatorial election last year, when Republican Glenn Youngkin stormed to victory in the state, which Biden won by 10 percentage points in the 2020 presidential race. The shocking losses in Virginia, thought to have turned reliably blue, came amid Democratic infighting over the size and scope of the president's domestic agenda, which remains stalled in the Senate.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
Our dear youth, who did not see nor feel the revolutionary era, should pay careful attention to these details. They must come to realize the issue behind this, U.S. animosity, and the main cause of it. If a people do not know what their main problems are or why, they will be misled. The concern for the U.S. is that the revolution came and saved the country from morasses of different types. From morasses of dependence, backwardness, political and moral corruption, and global humiliation. We were suffering in these models. We had become dependent, humiliated, and backward. We were held behind. They held us back in scientific fields, in economic pursuits, technological advancements, on an international presence overall in everything. And in return for these setbacks, we had American and English mistresses and sirs as our overseers.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In those days, we used to export oil 4 times more than the present time. Moreover, the population was half the size of today's population. However, most areas of the country were deprived of public and governmental services. It is the duty of governments to provide such services. The country was wallowing in poverty, backwardness, and moral corruption. Iran was in a terrible state, including all the infrastructure of the country. In the area of roadways, water-related issues, electricity, gas, public schools, universities, and civil services, it was suffering from a state of backwardness and poverty in all social, political, and economic areas. They used to offer up the country's natural resources of wealth to foreigners. It was only the ruling government that benefited from this situation. If the people spoke against their policies, they would silence the people by deception or either by methods of harassment or intimidation. Nevertheless, the people were angry and they could see the reality of the situation. The result was that they followed our magnanimous Imam's spiritual and divine call, which led to the revolution.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
the spotlight.
It has been 11 full years since the Bahraini Revolution Uprising, now in its 12th year, and Bahrainis continue with their struggle for independence. The trials and tribulations of Bahrainis include their citizenship being stripped and the dissolution of opposition groups like the Al-Wafaq Society. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at what stage this revolution is at and reflect on some of the prominent figures of the Persian Gulf Island and where they are at. The destructive role of Western countries backing the regime will also be looked at.
A popular uprising, better known as the Islamic Awakening, came to Bahrain a decade ago. On February the 14th, 2011, people of Bahrain staged a massive demonstration in the capital, Manama. It was the beginning of a movement that plunged the autocratic Al-Khalifa regime into an unprecedented crisis. In the early days of protests, Manama's Pearl Roundabout was the symbol of the uprising. Tens of thousands of people gathered here to peacefully call for reforms. Protesters demanded a parliament with a popular mandate and a new constitution. The Bahraini regime was, however, quick to show its intolerant face to dissidents. Regime forces attacked the demonstrators, who firmly stood their ground. The brutal crackdown left many people dead as the police, in many occasions, fired live rounds directly at protesters. The heavy-handed attack led to protests increasing in size and intensity, with angry demonstrators calling for the downfall of the ruling family. The regime became incapable of withstanding increasing popular outrage, so 1 month into the protests, Manama authorized troops from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates to enter the kingdom and help silence the voices of dissent with a harsher crackdown. Thousands of people were detained, including elected members of Bahrain's parliament. Many were tortured and killed in detention. The clampdown was rarely covered in Western mainstream media, and the Al-Khalifa regime didn't even get a slap on the wrist from the West for what it did to its own people. Critics say that's largely because the kingdom is a close American ally which hosts the United States Navy Fifth Fleet. Bahrain's uprising was suppressed, but did not die. Since 2011, anti-regime protests have been staged frequently in villages and towns across the tiny Persian Gulf kingdom. Scores of people have lost their lives and hundreds of others have been injured over the past decade. Authorities also targeted thousands of religious and political figures and activists, among them opposition leader Sheikh Ali Salman, who was handed a life sentence, human rights activist Nabil Rajab, that was imprisoned, and Shia leader Sheikh Isa Qasim, whose nationality was stripped. The regime managed to forcefully contain the uprising without addressing the people's demands. But what is certain is that the public discontent hasn't gone away and is instead pushed below the surface for now.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have from the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajareh, joining us from London. Also joining us, international human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan, who joins us on the phone from London, Ontario.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Master Shajar, let me start with you. When I think about the names that were just mentioned in that report, like Sheikh Ali Salman, like Nabil Rajab, not to mention Abdul-Hadi al-Khawaja, you know, these are people that are the icons. And looking at this revolution turning 12 and how that is still continuing and how Bahrainis are still going after what is their rights, which is defined in their search and quest for independence and freedom. What are your thoughts upon this revolution uprising that is now, as I mentioned, in its 12th year?
Absolutely. Remind myself to remind everybody else that Mr. Mushaima and Dr. Abdul Jalil, who's disabled, they are rotting in jail. Mushaima has got cancer and he's not been given medicine. And Dr. Abdul Jalil is on wheelchair and being tortured and denied basic rights. Look, the fact of the matter is that you know, when we say that the United States doesn't do anything because Bahrain is an ally, I don't think that's true. Bahrain is a servant, is sort of an island, which actually turns around to the United States, and whenever the United States says jump, it says, hi. This is not ally. This is actually abuse. United States is using and abusing Bahrain and Bahrainis and Bahraini sovereignty for their own sort of political interest and economical interest. And, you know, and they use the excuse that they are for democracy, they are for empowerment, they are for human rights. When you look and you see Bahrain every day, every hour, every month, every year, undermines these principles in a very vigorous and violent way. And everyone could see this. There's no democracy [S2] Sure. [S1] In Bahrain. And then, you know, the other allies of this tyrant kingship are the Israelis. Israelis are sometimes called the only democracy in the region. This is not, you know, this is really, they're not there because they want to support democracy or they are democracy. They're doing it because they are supporting another apartheid system. They're supporting another system which actually abuses its own people for the benefit of outsiders, be it Israelis or be it United States or be it anybody else.
Sure.
And this is the tragedy of this. And the fact of the matter is that there is wool being pulled over the eyes of the whole international community by these players. This sort of level of abuse, which you know, which you mentioned, and that, you know, if we want to go more in details,
yeah, we will.
Of how
I'd like to zoom in on what you have said, and let me ask you, Edward Corrigan. You know, Master Shajar talks about what the U.S. stands for, and the U.S. has a Fifth Fleet there. During the uprising, there were lots of protests that were happening, which ended up with a lot of people being detained, a lot of people beaten up on the streets, fired at, and many acts that undermined the whole notion of democracy, with the U.S. Fifth Fleet and its inhabitants watching on. Nothing was done about that. The regime continued with what it did. So I want to ask you, because of the fact that this is this anniversary, marking the anniversary of this uprising revolution, why is it that the U.S., in a sense, turned a blind eye to the atrocities that were going on, which it's still doing to this day, if you agree with that?
Well, they certainly didn't do anything to help the people of Bahrain. They do have a naval base in Bahrain where they've stationed the 5th U.S. fleet. Britain is also reestablishing a military base in Bahrain. And, of course, Bahrain is a feudal dictatorship, but it's an ally of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. And people should remember that whenever the uprising occurred back in, you know, I guess 11 years ago, the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates sent troops in to help suppress the popular uprising. So it was, you know, the Americans provided, you know, support. They didn't provide any criticism of the Saudis or the UAE or the Bahrain suppression of the popular movements. And of course, Bahrain has got a majority Shia population that is severely discriminated against, denied political rights. And even though there was a report, you know, condemning the actions of the government, nothing has been done. They've just increased repression, removing citizenship rights from people, keeping people in prison, some of whom have died because they haven't got proper medical treatment. And it's, you know, it's a feudal regime. But these are weak regimes that are dependent upon the Americans and British, and now they're bringing in the Israelis, of all things, to help prop up a regime that really has no legitimacy with its population and probably wouldn't last a week without the support of outside powers. And, okay, you know, it's...
Well, let me turn to what was, in a sense, an official acknowledgement of what the Bahraini regime was doing, Massoud Shajara, once this revolution was taken on into a high speed during that time. You had what was called the BICI recommendations, the Bassiouni report, if you recall. And the government of Bahrain actually acknowledged it. The report contained things like accusations of trials, torture, illegal detainment. The Bahraini king actually came out and said, we're going to adopt some of these recommendations. There were 26 of them. Now, to this day, I think only one may have been fully implemented, because we're still looking at, you know, the sham trials going on, torture is still going on, detainments are still going on. They didn't follow any of that. How is it that you have an illegal, you have a presentation made, an acknowledgement then made, but then for it not to be enacted or followed through by the regime?
Look, it's pathetic. I remember the Bahrain was first country which in the Human Rights Council in Geneva was brought forward on UPR, Universal Periodical Review. And we made a presentation regarding all these atrocities that are taking place and continues taking place. And then you're absolutely right, they came up with that report and nothing has been done. The reason for it is that, you know, we keep on saying that Bahrain is allies, Bahrain is sort of helping. No, Bahrain is killing in the name of United States. Bahrain is killing its citizens and in abusing its citizen in the name of Britain and now in the name of Israel, because that's what they want him to do. They don't want people to be empowered in Bahrain. United States, Britain, the Western allies, and definitely the Israel have got no intention of bringing democracy or empowerment to Bahrain. So Bahraini tyrants are not doing it and being tolerated. They are doing it on behalf of the West. They're doing it on behalf of Israelis. Look, the first person who died as a result of the uprising was a Sunni. This wasn't really, this was turned into a Shia and Sunni. Yes, of course, there is a large community, Shia community, which are being oppressed. But it's not the fact that, you know, Sunnis are having it, you know, are in power and they're having democracy and Shias don't. Everyone in Bahrain, every citizen in Bahrain has to be sort of a slave of the Amir. And the Amir is a slave of America and the Zionists and everybody else. And they allow them to do whatever they want because they will not, as my colleague said, they won't last even a few hours without their help and support. So when we say that Bahraini government and the Amir and the king is abusing and being tolerated is not correct. Actually, they're doing it on behalf of the interests of United States, Britain, and Israel.
Yeah, we're going to expand on this also a little bit more. Edward Corrigan, I'd like to come to you with the appointment of an Israeli officer that was just announced. We also have the Israeli Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, to maybe be there visiting the Persian Gulf island of Bahrain. What is the reason behind, well, we know the reason is this so-called formalization of ties. But in particular, what is the reason behind the appointment of an Israeli officer to be stationed there? What purpose is that going to serve?
Well, I suppose from the Bahraini government point of view, it's an attempt to solidify the tie between Israel and Bahrain. But you're putting you know, a person who is a real enemy or a potential enemy in a key position to influence and even try to control the Bahrain situation. I understand the person is the liaison between the British Fifth Fleet and the Bahrain government. Why on earth would anybody bring in an Israeli officer to be a liaison between the U.S. Fifth Fleet and the Bahrain government? This is that's my definition of insanity.
Okay,
you know, they should have somebody else of their own population for sure.
Let's look at why. Let's play a little bit of detective here, and please help me out, Master Shajara. I'm going down this path. If you think it's illogical, let me know. But I'm looking at the fact that they have appointed this Israeli officer, and it's not just an Israeli official. It's actually an Israeli naval officer. Now, the task that this naval officer has, ensuring freedom of navigation in the region's territorial waters, protecting international trade, and combating piracy and terrorism. Now, these are things that Israel itself has been accused of, but let's put that aside. We're looking at the fact that there's an oversight with Israeli involvement on an important waterway there. Kind of the same thing that's being cooperated between Israel and UAE when it comes to the Socotra Island. Again, another important waterway there. Are we looking at Israel to penetrating these different geographical locations with the help of the Arab regimes in order to control the waterways? Is that something that's a possibility?
Well, it is actually the fact. I mean, there is no reason, as my colleague said, that they would do this unless they actually want to empower Israelis to be involved in that territorial waters and in the international way. I mean, Hormuz and the Persian Gulf is one of the most important sort of waterways in the world. And Israelis have no way of being involved in there except thanks to the Bahrainis. And, you know, that's one issue. But I think also the other issue is that it seems that the Bahraini king doesn't trust its own citizens. You know, they've got a police officer from Metropolitan Police, retired, who's actually running sort of the police. They used to have someone from the intelligence services in Britain who was torturing people in Bahrain. You know, they have actually never trusted the Bahrainis. These guys are in power. They sort of looking at their country almost like a villa that is under their control, and they're willing to give as much power to others to do their dirty work in the region as long as it will help their security to stay in power and in their, you know, sit on their crown and rule. And, you know, this seems to be as basic as what is going on. But the intention of United States, the intention of Britain, and now the intention of Israel is very clear. They want to be involved and create and make that region less secure in the name of security. And this is actually could become extremely dangerous for the future of the region.
Sure. Well, Edward Corrigan, I mean, if we want to take a look at this situation from above, we're looking at the U.S. Fifth Fleet that's been in Bahrain for a long time. We're looking at the U.K. that established itself there, as you mentioned, back in the year 2017, I believe. Okay?
They were there before.
It opened a new naval base. And that was actually the first permanent military outpost in West Asia, or Middle East, as some call it, in nearly half a century. Then you have this Israeli naval officer also coming in there. Do you think that, based on what Sheikh Isa Qassam, a powerful, influential cleric, has said, that when the sovereignty of Bahrain is lost, that this is what's happening, and in exchange, it gives the regime a free hand to do what it wants with the Bahrainis by allowing these three entities to operate in the way that they will?
Well, it's really, from my point of view, it's a sign of weakness, that they are afraid of their own population. They are dependent upon the Saudis, United Arab Emirates, the Americans, the British, and now bringing in the Israelis to help keep themselves in power. But I'm sure the vast majority of the people in Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, UAE, have no interest and don't want the Israelis in a position of power and how to dominate or even to get influence in the area. But the Bahrainis are quite prepared to sacrifice their own independence and the sovereignty of their country to bring in what they think may, you know, increase their security. But in my view, it's only going to increase antagonism, and the people of Bahrain don't want that. But the Israelis have no interest in keeping, you know, Bahrain independent and free and, you know, prosperous. They want to dominate it, control it. And, you know, they've tried to bring in instability in almost every country they tried, even where they have peace treaties. They work to undermine the Jordanian government and the Egyptian government. And that keeps the instability gives Israel the opportunity to advance its interests. And of course, if they can control, have influence in Bahrain, and also they're illegally occupying Scrota off the coast of Yemen. And this is where the United Arab Emirates are collaborating with the Israelis and occupying the island. This is, you know, very, very destructive, but makes no sense. Israel is no friend of Bahrain, or not the Saudis, or the United Arab Emirates. They want to dominate and control, but some of these feudal regimes are so terrified of their own people, they're desperate to bring in outside powers, and they think that, you know, somehow having Israel or Britain or United States there will provide some support for them. It's limited support, but just like how Israel used to collaborate with the Shah of Iran, you know, whenever the Shah collapsed, Israel's ties were severed, and it became a big embarrassment for the Americans and the British and their allies.
I got to give 30 seconds to Master Shajara. Sorry for little time, since we're running out of time here. Master Shajara, we're looking at 12 years that this has been going on. I'm almost sure that if the government spent 12 years trying to negotiate something with Bahrainis, they would have had something done already, instead of throwing them in jail, sham trials, and doing the torture. But do you think it's a possibility that Big Brother Saudi Arabia doesn't want to see that happen in Bahrain, because then Saudi Arabia would be next?
Absolutely. I mean, people that are lost their nationality and end up in jail, most of them were actually members of parliament. You know, they're not, riffraffs, you know, and head of the political parties and so forth. The reality is that not only they've done that, but also they're demolishing their own independence by giving lots of nationality to other people to change the demography of the nationality in their country.
I'm sorry.
That
Master
is Shajara, another disaster.
We're just fresh out of time. I do apologize. Thank you very much for your contribution, Masoud Shajara, Islamic Human Rights Commission. And Edward Corrigan, a pleasure, international human rights lawyer. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Let me cover Tawai.